Bitcoin stands for truth, because as I've said before, and I like, that's one point I always try to make. Bitcoin is about producing a ledger of truth. So if you want to ban Bitcoin, you're against truth and you're against freedom. And that's not very American if you want to ban it.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining me once again on this episode of the Dumbest Guy in the Room podcast. I am your host, Eric Rao. Today we have renowned author and rabbit hole extraordinaire, Dur Gigi. On our episode, Gigi and I get into some very exciting topics as he takes us deeper down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. These topics include the history of fiat systems, the new Bitcoin ban in China, why it is that everyone in the world doesn't need to understand Bitcoin to the fullest extent for it to be successful, and how Bitcoin relates to time, and much more. Thanks so much for tuning in once again today as we dive down the Bitcoin rabbit hole even further. I hope you enjoy the show. All right, welcome back to the 9th episode of the Dumbest Guy in the Room podcast. Definitely the 10th episode. I'm excited to announce today that we have my first pseudonymous guest. He is a Bitcoin author, a software engineer, and a white rabbit chaser. Welcome, Gigi.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I like the white rabbit chaser. That's definitely true.
Yeah, I think it's fitting with the work that you've done in the past and what you've put out on the table. So if you want to, you know, give the listeners a little background on who you are and what you've done and what you do, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah, I think most people in the Bitcoin space know me from 21 Lessons, which is basically, it started as a very long tweet storm that I put out, and it eventually turned into a book. So most people really like the book and know me because of that. But as you said, I actually have a background in software and have been writing software in one form or another for the last 20 years almost. So I think that allowed me to have a little bit of a head start in the Bitcoin world, but nevertheless, it took me many years to fall down the proverbial rabbit hole. But yeah, now I'm here.
Perfect. Yes, yeah, it's funny. Even the software engineers and the programmers and everyone, you know, primed to understand it better, they still usually have a little bit of trouble learning about it at the beginning and figuring out everything that's going on, which yeah, you know, gives guys like me hope that maybe one day I'll have a little bit better understanding.
Yeah, it's definitely true. Like it feels to me that Bitcoin is like a 3D puzzle, like a sphere that consists of multiple puzzle pieces, and everything has to fit into place until your understanding is kind of stable. And if you have only like 4 or 5 pieces and it's only half done, then it doesn't make sense. You know, it's still very unstable. And even if you have been in software for a long time, you're missing all the game theory aspects. You're missing all the economic aspects. You're missing the money aspects. And so even though Bitcoin might be an interesting thing from a technological side of things, you only understand like not even a third of it. And that was my hold up basically. Like I understood the tech side very well, I think, but it didn't register how profound of an innovation it was, and it didn't occur to me that this was actually like a very profound shift on a societal level if Bitcoin was successful. And I, like, for the first couple of years, I kind of, you know, laughed a little bit about Bitcoin, like, oh yeah, this is the funny internet money, and just, you know, it will kind of go away one day or not work. And my understanding was still very superficial. So it took me, as I said before, many years to really understand it.
It's really funny. You can like dive into one part of it. Like, for example, you dove into the tech side of it first. And for me, I dove into the economics of it first. And then as I started to understand a little bit more, it slowly opened up all these other wormholes. Like you said, how there's just like five or more like very deep rabbit holes you can go down to start to try and understand like what's truly going on. And you have to understand each one on a very deep level. So it's just like hours of research of one, and then it opens another window, and it's hours of research on another. And you're just like, you can't get to the bottom of any one single side either.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've said this before. I think I maybe even wrote it in the book that I had a very good like formal education. Like I went to very good schools and went to university, and I was, you know, at university for a very long time because I was studying various things and just joined a research institute. So I was around the academia world for a very long time, but I still feel like once I started falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole after like 2 or 3 years, like exploring Bitcoin very deeply, I learned more than all the 20 years of formal education combined. You know, like it's just, it's still blowing my mind how good of a teacher Bitcoin is, because it kind of, it forces you to answer several very deep questions for yourself, and you have to answer them kind of completely, you know, like what is money? And like the question alone, why Bitcoin didn't die yet? Why is it still online? Why is it still alive? Like why the most powerful people in the world can't do anything about it? Why is that? You know, that's a really, really profound and deep question. And why has it never been hacked? You know, like Bitcoin has, the network has never been hacked. If it was hacked, it was only because exchanges were hacked or some people lost Bitcoin or whatever. But Bitcoin, the network, performed perfectly since its inception. Like no Bitcoin was ever double spent, or like the network never lost any Bitcoin, stuff like that. And why is that the case? Why can't it be the case? You know, like the first thing they teach you in any kind of cybersecurity classes is that there is no such thing as perfect security. You know, like every system can be hacked, every system has a flaw. So why is Bitcoin that secure? And all these questions, they will, you know, like you suddenly it's Sunday evening and you'll read, you know, Austrian economics textbooks that are 600 pages long, and it's just almost endless. So it's really a lot of fun.
Definitely, it is literally endless. I recorded with Tomer Strohlite yesterday, and he has this great quote that I love, and he says, "For those with the curiosity to look." And I think that resonates so heavily with me, because, like you said, you've learned more since you've been in the Bitcoin world than all your years of academia. And like for me, so I spent just 4 years in college, and I've learned more in the past 9-10 months of diving in heavily and reading than I did in those 4 years, probably my 4 years of high school, probably my 2 years of junior high, you know, all combined, because for the first time, it's been a subject that I've actually been curious about. I never had that in school. I had some subjects I kind of liked, but nothing ever really drove me to do the research on my own and do the extra work. It was, hey, I'm just going to do this to pass and get a decent grade. Yeah. But for the first time, that curiosity is overtaking me, like just, I want to learn more. And I'm just so intrigued by that. It's a pretty fun rabbit hole to go into, because so many other people in the space are the same, and everyone pushes each other to learn more and test their theories. And, you know, see, like if you put something out there as a writer that somebody else disagrees with, they're going to tell you they disagree with it, and they're going to tell you why. And then you can maybe restructure your thinking, or say, no, I believe in my thinking, and here is why. And it's a really cool way to learn, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of Bitcoiners, they came into Bitcoin because they wanted to find a flaw and wanted to, like, quote unquote, kill Bitcoin and show the world how it is insecure or why it won't work. Like, especially in the early days, that's how a lot of people came in. A lot of security researchers and computer science people, they tried to dismantle the system. And, you know, if after 2 years later, you still can't do it, then the only thing you can do is to convert, you know, convert to the other side and become a Bitcoin bull. And, that's what has been happening over and over again, and is still happening. You know, it's still funny. You see this sometimes even in the government sector, where some people are tasked to find out how you know, a certain government could attack Bitcoin or shut down Bitcoin, and they sometimes come to the conclusion, okay, it can't be done, and then they quit the government job and join a Bitcoin company or something else. So it's really funny to see. And with the learning in the open aspect, I think that's also an excellent point, because to me it feels like Bitcoin opened up this new universe, and we are all trying to collectively understand, like, what is currently happening, what is going on, and just answering the question over and over again. First of all, like, what is money, and also what is Bitcoin? Because Bitcoin has no fixed definition. It has no, like, nobody can really tell you what Bitcoin is, because you for yourself have kind of to define and to decide what Bitcoin is for you. And you define Bitcoin by running a set of consensus rules, running a software that you choose, that you decide, okay, this is Bitcoin for me. And if other people agree with your definition, then you can do business with them. You know, that's how Bitcoin works. That's how the whole system works. So there is no, because there is no one who can tell you what Bitcoin is, you have to decide it for yourself. So that's the whole idea of a decentralized system, kind of. And I think it's really beautiful because it opens up this world of exploration and discussion. And I think this will be an ongoing process as long as Bitcoin exists. It will get less intense, but we've already seen in the last couple of years where the block size wars happened, where there was a very technical discussion about what Bitcoin is and what the system should do and how it should evolve. And not all people agreed. So we had a very long multi-year civil war trying to figure this out exactly, like what Bitcoin is and what it should be. And we had, we fought an intellectual war over it. And I have the feeling that it won't be the last time where the question of what Bitcoin is has no clearly defined answer. And I think history will kind of repeat itself. It might not be as intense, but I think the question what Bitcoin is will, again, you'll have to answer it individually and make up your own mind. And so if there is no group consensus, then things will always get a little bit tricky.
Couldn't agree more. And like you briefly touched on earlier, you know, you had to teach yourself about game theory as well. We're about to see that play out with the nations. And so then it's going to say, okay, is anyone of the nations going to try and, like you said, redefine Bitcoin and what it means? And then they have the other nations that come in, just because they're drawn to a new idea. And so it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the coming years, because, you know, as much as we as like Bitcoiners, quote unquote, who think the game has already been played out and think we know like what the end looks like, it's not going to be just a smooth line to that. It never has been in the past, and there's no reason to assume that it changes moving forward just because, you know, there's Lightning Network now and more countries are starting to, or countries in general are starting to look at it and adopt it. There's no reason to assume that it's just going to be a smooth sail from here, because people who control the money are going to want to continue to control the money. They're not just going to want to give that up.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're spot on with the assessment. I completely agree that it will be a bumpy ride. And I have mentioned repeatedly that currently we're still living in peacetime, kind of, you know, like there is no outright war on Bitcoin or on Bitcoiners. And there's, as far as we can tell, no government attack going on, something like that. I think there are some nation states that, where adopting a Bitcoin standard for themselves is not in their best interest. And it's actually kind of funny to see how it is currently playing out, because it makes a lot of sense. It's just that not too many people thought about it, I think. Maybe nobody really thought about it deeply enough, like how will the game theory on the nation state level play out? Because what is currently happening makes all the sense in the world. With El Salvador, they don't have their own currency, like they use the US dollar. So they don't have the benefit of seigniorage, which is basically they can't print their own money. They are the slaves of the US government printing presses. So they don't have the benefit of printing their own money to do government spending. They only have the drawbacks, you know? And so it makes all the sense in the world for governments such as El Salvador to use Bitcoin instead, because it's neutral. It's way more neutral, you know, than the US government. It's way more stable also, you know, like it's you don't suffer all the problems related to inflation. And so I think we will continue to see smaller countries that are in similar situations join this Bitcoin bandwagon and also jump on a Bitcoin standard. But I also think it won't happen all at once, and it won't happen 100% in the sense of that everyone has to use Bitcoin now. I think it will be this parallel system that we currently see, you know, that I mean, it's not even in effect yet. It will be in effect in like 75 days from now, but still the outcome will be that the US dollar is the official currency and Bitcoin is the official currency. So you have like two systems, very similar to in Europe, for example, where everyone switched to the euro. There was a transition period where most countries had the old currency, the old national currency, and the new, you know, euro currency. And there were a couple of weeks or months, I don't even remember, where both were legal tender. And yeah, that's what we are seeing play out currently. But as Michael Goldstein said, which I love, it summarizes Bitcoin's game theory very well. It's a play on the nuclear holocaust film. I don't even remember the name. I think War Games is the name of the movie, and he paraphrased the essence of the movie. And in Bitcoin, it is the only winning move is to play. And so once you realize this, it automatically becomes a race. And I think all Bitcoiners kind of realize this, because every Bitcoiner knows, you know, it's a game of accumulation, and no matter how hard you work, the satoshis you stacked 3 years ago, you can't even work as hard to make up for that, you know, like it's it's an exponential monetization process. So everything you can stack today, you will be very happy that you stack those sets like 5 years from now, because no matter how hard you work 5 years from now, you won't be able to stack the same amount. So it truly, the only winning move is to play and kind of join the game quickly and yeah, play hard. And I think we see this also play out now with companies, you know, and I think we are very close to seeing the same race develop for nation states.
It's exciting times, to say the least. It'll be a wild thing to watch over the next, you know, 6 months, year, 5 years. Just everything is going to be pretty crazy to see how much everything changes.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty good segue, though, into, you've talked a bit in your writings about throughout history, we've always seen fiat money systems fail. And Can you dive into that a little bit about the history that we've seen behind fiat systems and kind of how we're seeing that play out in the present modern times?
Yeah, I think the pattern is as follows. If you are able to create your own money, you will always find a temptation to create more money. You know, there will always be some disaster scenario or some emergency where everyone agrees, okay, this is such an outrageous situation, we'll just go to the printing presses and we will make up this money out of thin air and we'll pay it back later. You know, it's just like, okay, we know kind of we're stealing from the future, and we know that this is kind of unfair to everyone else holding this money. But now there is, you know, this war, or this, to use the recent example, this pandemic or what have you, and you just use the money printers like literally like there is no tomorrow, you know. And so we've seen this all like over the last couple of thousand of years. Historically, I think the Chinese were the first ones that suffered from the fiat currency disease, so to speak. They thought it was a good idea to introduce paper notes instead of hard money. And of course, you know, like the people that are in power of the printing presses, they will abuse this power. That it doesn't matter why. It's always, again, it's always some emergency, some war, some something where these means are justified in their eyes. And yeah, we see this all over the world and throughout history, and whole nations decline because just the money doesn't work anymore. And we saw this, the downfall of Rome coincided with the downfall of the currency as well. And we also, another thing that's interesting is if two systems kind of collide and a strong currency kind of dominates a weaker one. For example, the go-to island in the Bitcoin world is the island of Yap, where they had this stone, like a currency made out of large stones, the Rai stones. And someone found out how to produce these stones very cheaply. And so he basically invented a money printer for himself to take over these islands. And the same is true also for Africa, you know, like the African slave beads in Africa, they used glass beads to for trade and as a money. And so the Europeans, of course, had very good technology to create glass in all forms. And so they were able to make these glass beads. And that's why they are known as slave beads, because you have in your own continent a money printer for another country, so to speak, and you create a lot of money and you ship this new money on your ships and you arrive at the other continent and you can buy pretty much anything because you have endless money. And that's how that worked back in the day. And I mean, in some sense, the same is true today. You know, we have the petrodollar system today, and the US dollar is basically the money of the world. Every currency basically is pegged to it, kind of. And so the US has the extraordinary privilege of printing money and exporting kind of the negative effects to the rest of the world. And it's the same story all over again. And in the end, like all economic goods, given a long enough time frame, the cost of a good will zero in on the cost of production. And if it doesn't cost anything to produce money, the money will, on a long enough time scale, will be worthless. And we see this over and over and over and over again. And every single fiat currency to date has died. And we see this now in Turkey, we see it in Venezuela, we see it in other countries where the currency is currently going through massive inflation or even hyperinflation. And in the end, you know, the people, they won't even pick up the paper notes anymore because they are literally worthless. And there are some people that find clever ways to make them worth a little bit again by, you know, producing handbags and other like artworks out of the currency notes. But the currency itself will be worthless, and the same will be true for the euro and the dollar and all the other fiat currencies.
Yeah, exactly. I saw this picture. This artist is doing a series. I believe it's with Venezuelan. Is it the Bolivar in Venezuela?
Yeah.
So the artist is doing a series where they put the amount of Bolivar it takes to buy a given item. And like one of them was like a baked whole chicken, rotisserie chicken.
Yeah.
And it was like the money stacked was like double the height and width of the chicken itself just to buy the chicken. And like you said, there people are starting to resort to using money to create handbags just because maybe they'll get a little bit more value from the handbag than they would from just the Bolivar themselves. It's a crazy, crazy world to see. And I mean, these countries are going to be the ones that really start hopefully looking toward Bitcoin as an out to fix the mistakes that they've made in the past and start to help give their people and their citizens a chance to survive and create a living wage for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just history repeating itself. You know, all this happened before. And if your listeners are interested in a great book that goes through a hyperinflationary period, it's called How Money Dies. And I think it's Neil Ferguson who wrote it. I'm not sure anymore, but How Money Dies is the title. And it's about the hyperinflationary period of Weimar Germany and how the German mark declined. And it's such a great book because it goes through journals of the people that lived at the time, and it just it chronicles the day-to-day life and the implications of hyperinflation. And it's a really sad book at times as well. You know, it's absolutely tragic and horrible because money is kind of, you know, the blood of a society. Like you need money for a society to work. Otherwise, like money solves so many problems. Money solves economic coordination problems. Money solves the problems of price signals. Money solves the coordination problem of barter. Yeah, like the complexity of barter. And money solves, you know, storing value and stuff like that. And so when the money breaks down, whole societies break down. There is no other way. You know, you have to resort to barter and other things, and that just doesn't work as well. And so it's the end result of money breaking down is always people starving in the streets, basically. So it's a really sad affair. But it's also you know, history is a great teacher. So reading books like this will really wake you up in regards to how important money is and what happens to a society if the money breaks down. And I think we are seeing the beginnings of that on a large scale now. You know, I think in part accelerated by the COVID pandemic, government spending and just the government printing of money is it's larger than it has ever been, you know, and we haven't felt the full effects of all this spending yet and all this money printing yet. But it's just the money supply of the US dollar increased by, I think, you know, a third or something like that over the last year and a half, or something outrageous like that. You know, I don't have the numbers on the top of my head, but I'm not off by that much. You know, it's something in that ballpark, and this will have some downstream effects, and we see it already for prices of some goods in the US. And again, because the US dollar is the reserve currency of the world, it will have global effects on all other economies as well. And so, yeah, I urge everyone to study this at least a little bit, you know, and How Money Dies is, it's a great book, and it's kind of a short read. And it will really open your eyes how important it is to have your hands on some hard assets like Bitcoin to survive periods like this.
Definitely. It's sad to read through those stories from history, but it's eye-opening because, you know, we can hopefully start to see the writing on the wall. And, you know, like you just touched on, the US dollar is the reserve currency of the world right now. And so, you know, with the way we've pegged everybody else to the dollar, more or less, I mean, I guess it's a little bit less than it was in the, you know, pre-71, but since everyone is more or less pegged to the dollar, all of the other currencies are going to fail first. And, you know, so the US, like people like me who are in the United States, we might not, you know, experience it day to day. Yeah, we see gas prices rising, and yeah, we see your grocery prices rising, but we don't see this hyperinflation that's going on in these other countries. But when you start to look at the ground level, you're like, okay, well, it can only go on so long in other countries before it comes all the way back to us at the top of the money printer, because we're just the closest. And so over time, it's, you know, you got to start, like you just said, you got to prepare yourself with having your hands on hard assets and, you know, just starting to look towards other things. Cause, you know, in Weimar, when they were going through their hyperinflationary period, you know, you could get out of the paper marks and into the gold marks. And that was the hard asset of the time. And now in the US, we have the option to, or I'm sorry, in the world, we have the option to change into Bitcoin as a hard asset and as the future store value of what everything's gonna be built on top of. And if you aren't starting to do this now, you could really miss the boat, because as we've seen through history, it's gonna happen faster than you think.
Yeah, it will be very interesting this time around, because we actually, you know, as you said, there is now global access to the hardest asset ever known to man, and everyone has access. And because of the fractional nature of Bitcoin, you can, you know, like you can buy a couple of Satoshis. You can, like, it doesn't matter how much money you have. You can buy Bitcoin. Like, even for a couple of cents, you can buy Bitcoin. You know, now with Lightning, this is actually possible. And so it will be very interesting how this plays out, because historically, this wasn't true. Historically, only certain sets of people had access to hard assets. So you had to be rich already to buy gold or silver. You had to be rich already to buy real estate and other things. You had to be well connected to get your hands on like a stable currency, for example. And today, this is just not true anymore. The only thing you need is like a smartphone, basically, you know, like some internet access. But even that's not true. Like, you know, like you can go to your favorite dealer and basically to own Bitcoin, you only need to have like 12 words stored somewhere, you know, like it's you really don't need much to own Bitcoin. And so I'm very hopeful that, because we have this pressure valve, kind of like we have this exit door, that things will be a little bit different, maybe not as catastrophic as they have been in the past. Because I think you mentioned in the beginning, when you talked about Tomer, that he mentioned for the curious, you know, I think that's very true. I also like the saying of Alex Svetsky, who is always saying that in Bitcoin, you either learn through curiosity or through pain, you know. And I think we are still at a stage where most people that are currently in Bitcoin learn through curiosity, but the pain will come. And I think since we have Bitcoin now, maybe the pain will not be fatal. You know, like if the pain is big enough, you will kind of be forced into Bitcoin. And we saw this on dark markets and on gray markets. We saw this in other industries that just in general have trouble with the traditional banking system, like, you know, in the marijuana industry or in the erotic industry. And so all these people were forced to use Bitcoin because of the pain they went through with the legacy system. And also in other countries where the currencies are failing, a lot of people were forced to use Bitcoin for remittances or other things, just to hedge against inflation or to protect themselves from inflation. And I think the pain will become more and more going forward. And I hope that Bitcoin will serve all those people well. In fact, like my main thesis is that Bitcoin is the most reliable, most stable thing there is in this world. So I'm convinced that Bitcoin will serve all those people well.
I agree with all that said there. And one reminder I want to remind listeners about is, like you said, you can buy sats for a couple cents. You can buy sats for a couple dollars. I was at a bar a few weeks back, and this guy and I ended up started talking about Bitcoin, you know, of course, as it goes. And and he asked a question. He's like, well, don't you have to buy like one whole Bitcoin? Is it too expensive? And I opened Cash App and I bought $1 worth of Bitcoin right there. And it was, you know, probably at the time, 2,500 sats. And he was like, oh, like I didn't know that. And it was, you know, you don't have to put in whatever the dollar amount is today, probably $34,000-ish at a time to buy one Bitcoin. You can buy a couple Satoshis, which are, you know, the fractional unit of Bitcoin, and start to stack that way. You don't have to go all in all at once. So it's just such a different system than what people are used to thinking in like whole units and round units, as far as like stocks go, because that's where so many people's minds go to the share price of Berkshire Hathaway. I can't afford to buy one whole share of BRB, or I think it's BRK. But you know, with one Bitcoin, you don't have to. And it's just such a transition, because Bitcoin isn't a stock. Bitcoin is the future of monetary asset. And so you start to think of like sats as pennies or dollars rather than, you know, a unit of a stock. And have you noticed like people struggling with that type of framework in their mind?
Yeah, 100%. Like I've noticed this for like forever, basically. Like unit bias was always a thing in Bitcoin, and that's why also, you know, memes formed around this unit bias. There are t-shirts that basically say you can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin, you know, because so many people just don't know. So just repeating this phrase over and over again that you can actually buy a fraction of a Bitcoin is already helpful, because I'm you know, like it's still so early. I'm not sure what the numbers are, but I think very recently in the developed world, in the Western world, we crossed from the innovator stage to the early adopter stage, which is, I think, like 12.5% of people using a technology. And globally, you know, we are still in the single digit percentages of people having any contact with Bitcoin, you know, like having bought it once, you know, having transacted with it once. And so it's probably like 90% of people worldwide that don't know that you can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin. So that's how early we are. You know, they have no idea that one Bitcoin consists of 100 million satoshis, and on the Lightning Network you can go even farther than that. You can buy milli satoshis, you know, like you can buy 1/1000th of a satoshi on the Lightning Network. And there's also no real limit to that, you know, like you can dividing Bitcoin further down is not a problem. It's very similar to, like, you have one pizza, you know, you can slice it up however you want, you know, it's not limited to 8 slices or anything like that. And like technically you can do that. Like currently Bitcoin works in this way, where one Bitcoin is 100 million satoshis. On the Lightning Network we have the subdivision of milli satoshis, but there is no reason why on the higher layers especially we cannot divide it further. So you can buy a grain of sand worth of Bitcoin in theory. Like it's it might be a ridiculous concept, but it's actually possible. And a lot of people, they just, you know, they don't have the time to to kind of deal with all these issues. Life is complicated and they just want to, you know, have a place where they can put their savings somehow. And they just don't trust Bitcoin. Bitcoin is still too new. You know, Bitcoin is still this kind of weird internet money. Bitcoin is still, you know, not too long ago, a couple of years ago, all you heard in the news about Bitcoin was related to some, you know, like drug marketplaces and hitmen hired online and all kind of weird things, you know, that where, you know, I'm not saying all of this did never happen, but the overwhelming majority of economic activity on the Bitcoin network was always related to trading, you know, and not necessarily, you know, buying hitmen online. So, but of course, you know, that doesn't sell newspapers. So the most outrageous headlines will be remembered and will also sell the most newspapers. So that's what people know. And we are still at the stage where most people have no idea what Bitcoin is or how it works. And unit bias is one of the main problems. And the other things that new people always mention, it's always the same, you know, it's like, what if the internet is being shut down? What if electricity doesn't work? What if Bitcoin gets hacked? What if governments shut it down? Bitcoin isn't backed by anything. So we need something that is backed by gold, for example. China controls Bitcoin. Bitcoin consumes too much electricity. Like, those are the general narratives that the phases that people go through, you know, and there are very good rebuttals against all of those arguments. And some of these arguments are even bordering on the nonsensical, but it's a journey and you have to kind of figure all of this out for yourself, because as it is now, the mainstream media and CNBC and regular books don't help you too much.
We need to get one newspaper or publication that will allow a pro Bitcoin article, and it goes the complete opposite direction, rather than, you know, Bitcoin is used for hitmen or Bitcoin is used for terrorists or whatever the FUD of the past is that, you know, has been debunked many times. Just like one crazy headline for the positive that says like Bitcoin will consume all of other money in time, you know, so something like that, and yeah. Like get the clickbait in the other direction and get people's eyes opened up.
I think we're getting there. I think Bitcoiners have written some borderline outrageous things in the last 1 or 2 years that are along these lines. You know, I remember seeing a headline, you know, like Bitcoin will literally save the environment and things like that, which is, you know, it's in my mind, it's not even that outrageous, because Bitcoin has the right incentive structure. It is the buy of last resort for energy and especially stranded energy. So if you usually if you produce energy, you try to sell it to the market, but if the market doesn't pay you enough, Bitcoin will always be there to actually buy this energy from you. And so it fits very well in the renewable sector, for example, where you have different dynamics from energy production and energy demand, and Bitcoin can actually jump in there and help. But, you know, it takes a lot of study and a lot of like understanding of different topics to actually make sense of this all. And so at first glance, it of course sounds outrageous, and most people that listen to this, if you are not a Bitcoiner already, you probably won't believe a word that I have said. But I think also that the tide is kind of shifting, you know, with larger companies and more serious money coming in, and also large energy producers coming in that actually look at this thing seriously. I think all of this is currently underway. Like the narratives are currently shifting. Like Wall Street is slowly coming in, large funds are coming in, more serious people are coming in, you know, as compared to 8 years ago, where literally the only people that had any contact with Bitcoin were insane people on some sort of spectrum for sure. You know, like you had to be an anarchist, cypherpunk, computer hacker to be able to make sense of Bitcoin and even to use it. And now all of this is changing, you know, like we have millionaires and billionaires building companies around Bitcoin and moving their funds into Bitcoin in a very big way, because everyone has the same problem, you know, like nobody knows where to store their money. Like you can't really buy real estate. It's way overpriced depending on where you are. It's also, you know, not mobile and you can't store it in fiat currencies like the US dollar or the euro or what have you, or the yen, because it literally will melt away over the years. And, you know, so most people just put it in the stock market, in the S&P 500 or what have you. But, you know, I mean, stocks have only been going up. So a lot of people are uneasy about the stock market as well. So more and more people with serious money consider Bitcoin as a serious option to as a store of value. And so when the big money comes in and the politically connected come in, the narratives have to change, because once you have skin in the game and you store your time and money in Bitcoin, then you want Bitcoin to succeed as well. So it makes no sense to attack it on a narrative front.
Exactly. We've seen this big wave in the past year of, you know, more and more prominent figures being willing to come out and speak publicly about their belief in Bitcoin, their positions in Bitcoin, and what they see moving forward. And like you just mentioned, you know, it's getting to the point now where if the US were to try and take a negative stance against Bitcoin, there's so many well-connected and deeply invested individuals that just like this wouldn't fly, because at the end of the day, you're going to protect where your money is. And, you know, if Stan Druckenmiller and Michael Saylor and, you know, Elon Musk is, you know, is what he is, but, you know, he has owns Bitcoin. So at the end of the day, if the US were to try and ban it, these people are going to come up and, you know, lobby against the US for Bitcoin and start to protect the asset in that way. And so it's going to be very interesting, because like we just saw China, they banned mining and are trying to take a more firm stance against Bitcoin. But all it's doing is going to further decentralize the hash power that we have of the network, and just really start to spread that out. And so it's actually going to be positive for other nations.
It's a very effective way to destroy the FUD narratives of China controls Bitcoin and all the mining is centralized in China. So thank you, China, for being the authoritarian state that you are and just banning all Bitcoin mining. It really helps all the Bitcoiners of the world to destroy this stupid narrative. But what you said is definitely true, that people will defend it, and that's one of the kind of interesting things about Bitcoin, that it is this mind virus of sorts. But I think it's also that just truth is on our, like, truth and freedom are on our side, you know. And if the US, for example, would come out swinging and wanted to ban Bitcoin, like, what are they even doing? Banning a voluntary messaging system that promotes freedom and individual sovereignty that you are not forced to use. It's completely voluntary. Every interaction with the Bitcoin network is completely voluntary. It doesn't hurt anybody, you know, like it's completely, again, completely voluntary, completely optional. You can opt in. You don't have to use Bitcoin. It's it has like almost zero negative externalities in terms of mining, if you truly look at it, you know, compared to other industries, compared to other settlement layers, compared to other financial networks and things like that. And it's at the end of the day, Bitcoin is code and code is speech. So if the free speech country would come out swinging and wants to ban Bitcoin, I think we will have the same war all over again that we fought in the 90s about cryptography. And in the end, people printed out cryptographic algorithms and put them on t-shirts and put them into books and just showed the US government that code is speech. And if you are true to the Constitution, there is nothing you can do about it, because the same goes for Bitcoin. You know, I can put a Bitcoin transaction into a book and I can publish it. I can put the Bitcoin source code into a book and I can publish it. I can mine Bitcoin with pen and paper and put it into a book and publish it. You know, like, Bitcoin literally is speech. So it will be really hard for the US to do anything about it in any meaningful way. And stands for freedom, and Bitcoin stands for truth, because as I've said before, and I like, that's one point I always try to make. Bitcoin is about producing a ledger of truth. It is the closest thing, like, the output of Bitcoin is the closest thing we have to absolute truth in our universe. You can never be sure about what happened, because you always have to rely on historical records and what other people said and what other people wrote down. But in Bitcoin, the evidence is based in the data, in the information itself. And that's why it's so valuable. You know, you can verify everything yourself, going back to the Genesis block, and that's how Bitcoin works. So if you want to ban Bitcoin, you're against truth and you're against freedom. And that's not very American if you want to ban that.
Couldn't agree more. That was very, very well said. You know, as as these nations start to, you know, even consider this, because they've missed their chance. They had the chance for probably the first handful of years of Bitcoin, and they could have maybe done something about it then. They, you know, maybe mine or had enough hash power or whatever you maybe want to say for a nation state attack. But now it's so decentralized and it's such a powerful network that they're either going to have to adopt or do what China's doing and try and ban it. And if you do what China's doing and you try and ban it, you're just going to set yourself back on a global scale because someone else will adopt it. If the US said, we're going to ban Bitcoin, and Canada turned around and said, we're going to embrace Bitcoin, well, what's going to happen to all the monetary value that is stored in Bitcoin in the United States? It's just going to move to Canada. And then as it progresses forward, it'd be like in the 90s, if the US was like, we're going to ban the internet or limit the internet or whatever you want to say. It's United States is successful today because it embraced the internet and it embraced, you know, new technologies throughout the past 100 years, after the wars were wrapping up. And as we embraced those technologies, it brought in economic success to our nation and, you know, continued forward. And if we don't do that with Bitcoin, we're going to be left behind. And China didn't embrace the internet initially. And so they've been fighting an uphill battle for the past couple of decades as they've been trying to come back to the global power level. And, you know, they're right there now. But if they continue with this ban of Bitcoin, they're only going to set themselves
back. They are making the same mistake all over again. And I really like the saying, I don't know who came up with it first, but it goes, you cannot ban Bitcoin, you can only ban yourself from the Bitcoin network, you know, and that's basically what's happening on the nation state level now. Like it's really the wrong move, you know, like you're not banning Bitcoin, like Bitcoin doesn't care. You're only removing yourself from the Bitcoin network and all the opportunities it brings. And that's a really stupid idea. Like there are no other words than stupid, because it's an exponential technology built upon other exponential technologies. So the benefits that Bitcoin brings with it, they will happen really quickly. And Bitcoin is still at the very, very, very early stages of its monetization process. So if you are missing like the curve, the knee of the curve, you have missed most of it. So if you're banning yourself from the Bitcoin network and it's going to happen in the next 10 years, let's say, and you don't reverse this ban in the next 10 years, then you've missed the boat. Like that's what's going to happen. It's very similar to, you know, like banning the use of smartphones. Like how long did it take for the first, like the iPhone was introduced like 13 years ago or something like that. So it didn't even take a decade until everyone had a smartphone. So imagine banning the use of smartphones in your country and just, you know, taking 10 years to reverse that ban. You missed everything. You missed all the opportunities that smartphones bring with them. And with Bitcoin, I think it will happen even faster because the infrastructure is already there. You only need Bitcoin is a communications protocol. You only need something that is very good at communicating data, which is smartphones and the internet. You know, that's all you need. So everyone has a smartphone already, and everyone kind of has access to the internet already as well. And for mining, the same is true. Like you only need an energy source and a data connection. And it doesn't matter what kind of data connection. It could be radio, it could be satellite, doesn't matter. You know, like you don't even need internet. You can just put up a satellite dish and use the Blockstream satellite, for example. You can use the neighboring country and use TX10 or some other technology to broadcast transactions and to do other things. You know, like, I mean, I'm not saying it's easy to do, but in principle, it's possible. You don't even need like proper internet to do mining. You just need some form of energy and some form of a communication channel. And so again, banning yourself from the Bitcoin network, this is what you're doing, and you're not doing yourself a favor. And I know I sound like a broken record, but like exponentials, they happen really quickly, and Bitcoin's monetization process will be an exponential process. Like there is no other way, you know, like with more usage, and usage is always an exponential curve. All technological adoption curves are exponential. Doesn't matter if it's for TV or for cars or for trains or for electricity or for running water or for smartphones or for the internet or for using Snapchat or for using Facebook or for using Google, what have you. It's always a very slow start. And then suddenly everyone is using it. And then you're suddenly at like 90-95% penetration, and then it slowly tapers off. So it's always those very steep S curves. And they speed up. Like, you know, I don't know how long it took for Google to get to 1 billion users or for the electricity grid to get to 1 billion users, but it didn't take that long for Snapchat, you know, like or for TikTok, like pick your app, you know, it takes a couple of months until there are really many users using this thing. And Bitcoin is not only like, it's not the new shiny app. Bitcoin is a really fundamental technology and a very useful one at that as well. It is like electricity, just most people don't view it as that, like most people don't have a proper understanding and just not the need for it yet. You know, it was very similar with smartphones. When the smartphones came out, everyone's like, why would I need a smartphone? You know, like that's the most stupid thing. I have a phone already and why would I need a smartphone? It doesn't work properly and so on and so forth. And that's the opinion that most people have currently of Bitcoin, but they're dead wrong.
Yep, exactly. And you know, most people who have that opinion still just haven't dove into the research and why. And literally just yesterday, Tomer and I, when we were recording, we talked about, you know, the exponentials like you were just talking about, and with regards to like information distribution. So I brought up the point of, you know, when the printing press was invented, you know, it takes a long time, but it's distributing information around the globe at a faster pace. And then when the telephone gets introduced and the fax machine gets introduced, as they build their network, as more nodes, quote unquote, come online, more information can be transferred quicker and quicker. And then when the internet comes online, it just exponentially increases the speed because the telephones, you know, they can't send words over the, or I'm sorry, they can't send text over the phone. They can only send words. And then now it's Bitcoin. So now it's getting faster and faster and faster with every iteration. And then this one's just going to be so unbelievably quick because of what we've seen over the past, you know, 40-ish years with the internet. The Bitcoin network is built on that, and it's just going to take off so much faster.
And I see like two things happening in the future, and I can't tell you exactly when, and I can't even tell you in what order they are going to happen, but there will be one killer app that uses Bitcoin that suddenly everyone uses. And it might just be Strike, you know, like we see now in El Salvador, it was basically made possible by Jack Mullers and the team at Strike, which uses Bitcoin and the Lightning Network underneath. And it feels like a regular kind of payment / banking app. But and everything you see is like US dollar denominated and stuff like that, but it uses Bitcoin underneath. And so there will be one app that's just very easy to install, very easy to use, accessible globally, and everyone will want to have it and install it for some reason. And it will drive a lot of adoption. And the second thing that's going to happen in the future is like an infrastructure inversion of the current payment systems. And we saw this with the internet as well. You know, everything that uses information was eaten up by the internet. And this is still going on, you know, like this is still happening. And so the same will be true for Bitcoin. Everything that has to do with value will be eaten up by Bitcoin in some form or another. And especially what I'm talking about is everything that has to do with value transfer. So currently we have all kinds of different settlement systems across the world that the banks use, like, you know, SWIFT in Europe and ACH in the US. And I'm sure, you know, there are others that I don't know about in China and Japan and whatnot. And all of, like, there is no reason why the banks cannot use Bitcoin and do it way more efficiently, just like the telephone companies switch to the internet. And like they had, you know, like hundreds and thousands of people sitting in large rooms, routing telephone lines by literally unplugging things and plugging them in another hole. And there came a day where, okay, why aren't we using the internet to do the same thing? And all telephony went over the internet. The end users, most of the time, didn't even know or didn't realize. You get a new phone and it, you know, the beeps are a little bit differently, but who cares? It's still a telephone and it still works. And everything is going over the internet and nobody knows. And the same will be true for Bitcoin. You know, all the bank transfers, doesn't matter what you do with money, all of it will go over the internet, over Bitcoin. And you probably won't even realize, you know, it's just, it looks just like Strike, you know, it looks like a regular banking app. You have dollar amounts and so on and so forth. And I see this happening like somewhere around the next 8 years or so. Like I'm being very optimistic, and I'm not saying that all the legacy banks will necessarily switch, but there will, like, there is a lot of competition coming, you know, like if you look at we basically have Bitcoin banks already. They are the Coinbases and the Krakens of the world. And if you look at the valuations of these companies, they are ridiculous. You know, like they are, Coinbase is already like in the top 10 banks of the world or something in terms of valuation. And this won't stop. Like this literally won't stop. There is no reason to think why this will stop. And so in the next 8 to 10 years or something like that, I see global settlement moving to the Bitcoin network and just new types of banking infrastructure emerge that will use Bitcoin underneath. And of course, you know, the Bitcoin network will get crowded, kind of like block space is very limited. And that's what will drive everything else. You know, it will drive up fees, it will drive up mining, it will drive up the price, it will drive up usage. So in my mind, you know, since for a while, it's it's only up. Up is the only way the number can go.
Yeah, I like to think in about 10 or 15 years, practically everything will be built on the Bitcoin network and no one will even think twice about it anymore. You know, just like now we jump on the internet from our smartphone. We don't think twice about how that works.
Exactly. Yeah.
But exactly here very soon, you know, everything is going to be built on the Lightning Network for the upper levels. Or like you mentioned with Strike, how easy it is to use. I onboarded my mom to Strike the other day and set her up with a blue wallet, Lightning wallet, and had her sending herself Satoshis from Strike within 10 minutes. And she's like looking at it and like, she gets it, but she's like, at the same time, I was like,
it's wait, like magic,
I'm,
right?
I'm on it now. Yeah. And it was like this awesome like thing to see, because she's like, oh, like I have Bitcoin now. And like, I'm, you know, interacting with the network and like, but she doesn't have to understand everything that's going on in the base layer, you know, for it to work. She doesn't have to do the hours and hours of research that, you know, crazy people like us have done, but she can use it. She can interact with the network and she can see how fast the instant settlement is and start to be intrigued by it and like just opened her eyes.
Yeah. The example you mentioned is perfect with our smartphones that are online all the time. Nobody knows how it works. That's exactly right. And it still blows my mind how well networking in our current day and age works. You know, I mean, there are still, you know, like sometimes a Zoom call drops, or sometimes, you know, you have some trouble connecting to some Wi-Fi. So it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But I still remember the very early days of networked computers where, you know, you didn't even have TCP/IP yet. You know, like I remember a time before that where you actually had to connect the computers in the right order, set everything up, tell the system like, this is computer number zero, this is computer number one, and you build like this token ring network where, you know, the signal can only go in one direction. You didn't even have like broadcast systems or anything like that, and it was hell to set up and configure. And it was, you know, like I was like 10 years old or something like that, so I didn't really know what I was doing. But I still remember this very vividly, because you were able to play computer games with other real persons. You know, that's why that was my main motivation to set this up. I have a big gaming past, and the first time I figured out that I can actually play against other people that are sitting on the other side of the room and I don't see what they are doing on the monitor, that was like magic. It was mind-blowing to me. And so we are now at a stage where you have your smartphone and you go into, I don't know, a McDonald's or something, and you scan a QR code and you're in the Wi-Fi and everything works, you know, or you enter some stupid password and you're already online and your phone remembers everything. And when you're going home and you walk through the door, the Wi-Fi activates automatically and it will connect automatically and everything just works. And you have like 5G basically everywhere, and just everything is amazing. And you can stream 4K video all the time on Netflix. And it's absolutely mind blowing how this works, you know. And underneath, it's still kind of the same technology, you know, like TCP/IP hasn't changed that much. It's still like zeros and ones flying back and forth. Like that's what's happening. And the same will be true for Bitcoin. You know, the Bitcoin network, the fundamentals of the Bitcoin network won't change that much. It will be still Satoshis flying back and forth, but you will not have to know about block sizes. You will not have to know about difficulty adjustments. You will not have to know about the Lightning network. You will not have to know about, I don't know, channel sizes or liquidity or what have you. You know, all of this will be abstracted, just as it is abstracted now in the networking world. You know, you don't have to know about all the internet routing protocols and all the different things and all the different handshakes that your phone is doing with your router and the router is doing with your internet service provider and all those kind of things. Like, nobody cares. There's like a very small amount of people that know these things, and if something breaks, those are the people that will fix it. And the same will be true for Bitcoin. Like, nobody has to know how it works. It will just work. And I feel like we're very close to this already. Like, Lightning is blowing me away. Strike is blowing me away. I was lucky enough as a European to have like alpha access to Strike, and it's just mind blowing how well it works. You know, it's literally magic. And you don't have to take care about anything. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to balance your channels. You don't have to pay any kind of taxes on your Bitcoin, on the Bitcoin fluctuation, so to speak. And this is exactly what needs to happen for a Bitcoin standard to emerge kind of organically. We need those intermittent steps, and Strike I see as an intermittent step between the fiat world and the Bitcoin world.
Yeah, the rails to onboard new people have to be seamless. You have to be able to get my mom on in 10 minutes. Yeah. You have to be able to, you know, introduce this new technology to other people, but without having to teach them how to use a whole new cell phone. Because like, that is what holds people back, is the technology. And, you know, like you mentioned, you can walk into a McDonald's, you can scan the QR code and your Wi-Fi works, and you can stream 4K video right there from Netflix. Everyone takes that for granted of what's actually going on the back end, like, and how crazy that really the technology really is. But in the next couple of years, and I mean, there's already places that are doing it, when you order at that McDonald's, you know, rather than the little credit card reader popping up where you insert your card, it's just going to pop up with a QR code. You're going to take that same cell phone camera that you use to scan the Wi-Fi QR code, and you're going to scan the QR code that pops up, and your iPhone mobile wallet is going to, you know, read your Face ID just like it does to unlock your phone, and you're going to send the $4 for your cheeseburger to McDonald's right there without pulling out a credit card, doing anything on the back end, typing in a PIN, because, you know, mobile integration is going to happen. Strike's already doing it now. Blue Wallet, Moon Wallet, Sphinx Chat, all these other companies are starting to do it. Apple is going to have to do it to compete.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And Google's going to have to do it to compete, you know, with their devices. Yeah. And it's going to happen so fast.
Yeah, yeah. It's also funny. It's kind of ironic, because not only will they have to do it to compete, they will also be legally obliged to do it because of developments like El Salvador moving to a Bitcoin standard. Because if you are a global company and you're operating in El Salvador and someone has an outstanding debt and wants to pay you in Bitcoin, you're obliged to accept this Bitcoin, you know, if you're technically capable to do so. And Apple is definitely capable to do so, and Tesla is as well, and McDonald's is as well. So I expect to see a lot of things happening in the next like 2 or 3 months on that regard, in like payment, point of sale payment terminals that can handle Bitcoin transactions, that can handle Lightning transactions. And as you said, you know, it might happen via QR codes. It might happen via, like in China, for example, WeChat and Alipay and all those services, they use QR codes massively. So in China, people are very used to paying with QR codes for years and years already. And of course, like all the new phones, they have NFC chips, like near field communication. All the smartwatches have that too. And most payment terminals have that too. And in Europe, for example, that's very widespread. All the credit cards and other debit cards have NFC chips, and since years most people are paying just by tap to pay. You know, you tap your card on the terminal and it's just done. And you can do the same with your phone. You know, you can tap your phone on the terminal and you pay it. And there is no reason why you can't do this, and it uses Bitcoin underneath. There's zero reason why this shouldn't work, you know. And I've been talking about this for quite a while already, and I expect this to happen quite soon. Like I mean, it might still take a couple of years, because again, we're still very early, Bitcoin is kind of weird and so on and so forth. But with the recent developments of Strike and El Salvador and other things, it might happen, you know, like there might be some company or some team that is already beta testing this stuff and we don't know about it, and like in 3 months they will release a product and everyone will be blown away, and it has NFC and all of it enabled, and it has a small app on your Apple Watch and it just uses Lightning underneath. And you know, why not? All these payment terminals, if you look at in the US, for example, a lot of payment terminals, they use Square, and that's one company. And I mean, there are some Bitcoin bulls at this company, and of course, you know, Jack as the CEO, he's a massive Bitcoin bull, and I wouldn't be surprised if Square updates their it's just software. That's why it's so amazing. You know, they update the terminals and suddenly they are Lightning enabled. Like, there is no reason why this can't happen in the next 6 months or so. And that's what I expect to see happening at some point in the future. I can't tell you when, but this is going to happen. It makes all the sense in the world. It's way cheaper to do. Like, the banks that take care of your payments at the settlements, they take a cut on every way. So I expect if you have the infrastructure and the technical means to do it, and you use the Lightning networks, you're probably like 10% cheaper than all your competition. Like I expect something like that, you know, and that's just wild. Even if it's just a couple of percent, you know, even if it's like 2 or 3%, if you're a large company, that's way worth it. And so just for economic reasons alone, this is bound to happen. But of course, you know, we also have Bitcoin standards emerging geopolitically, and so you're kind of forced to do it as well, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah, I don't think it's very long before you hear more and more stories about small business owners that say, you know, Bitcoin only, or, you know, because they're going to be able to take a increasing asset. Yeah. They're going to be able to save on fees and instant settlement. Yeah. It just makes perfect sense. And I was actually debating with my buddy on this the other day. How long do you think it is before Apple like releases, say, an integrated, like Bitcoin integrated into their mobile wallet?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like, I mean, we've seen some cryptographic chips integrated in some mobile phones already. I think Samsung came out with something last year. I mean, it didn't really gain traction yet. And Apple, of course, is well positioned to do something like that. I mean, they claim to care about their users' privacy and security and things like that. So it makes a lot of sense to integrate this directly into the Apple hardware so that key management is just taken care of, kind of. But it's an interesting question on how it will happen. Like, I can't tell you all these things are going to happen because it makes all the sense in the world, but I don't know what will happen first, because what we see, to me, in my mind, it kind of all happens at the same time. And for example, you know, in Bitcoin Beach in El Salvador, there are people that are only accepting Satoshis, you know, and we also see for some larger purchases, there are, you know, I saw houses being sold, for example, and it says on the sign, you know, Bitcoin preferred, for example. And I know people that preferably invoice in Bitcoin, and they just, you know, if you are not able to pay in Bitcoin, they will charge you double. So if you do some contracting work, and like, that's something to think about as well. And I think we will see this more and more, that it's just, you know, Bitcoin is my preferred money. If you're not able to go through the hassle, quote unquote, to give me what I want, I will just charge you a premium of, you know, like 21% or even 100% or whatever. And I'm totally with you. I think this is something that is bound to happen. And there are some Bitcoin stores, for example, already that sell merch and other things that will only accept Bitcoin. So that we are already there. It's just not evenly distributed.
It's wild too how easy it is. Like, so I went to BitDevs in Austin last week, and to pay for the barbecue after BitDevs, they had it set up. I think it might have been BTC Pay server, or one of, if I'm wrong, sorry, but one of those. And I opened it up, and I saw it was a Lightning only. I copied the address, I opened Strike, I pasted the address, and I had an email within, you know, 2 seconds that your payment is confirmed, you're on the list. And it's so seamless. You know, it's so much easier than typing in your credit card information. It's so much easier than, you know, finding someone's address on Venmo. Yeah. It's all right there. The information's all right there. And if I was on 2 devices, I could have just scanned the QR code with my camera. It's wild how easy it's going to be in the future.
Yeah, it's way easier. It's way more secure. It's way more private. It's way faster. It's way cheaper. Like, it checks all the boxes. So that's why everyone will use it. You know, like, it's that's also why I kind of flip-flop on this, but I heavily agree with, like, I have a lot of sympathy with all the people that say that Bitcoin doesn't need any kind of, you know, promotion or education or anything like that, because it will all happen on its own, kind of. It's very similar to, you know, you don't need to make the case for email and go from post office to post office and just explain to all the post office people why email is superior. You just don't. You don't have to do it, you know. You can literally go to the post office and tell them to have fun sending mail and just go home and use email. And that's basically the argument of a lot of Bitcoiners. I mean, the counter argument is, of course, that I think the only reason why Bitcoin is not more widespread, or maybe not the only reason, but one of the biggest reasons why Bitcoin use isn't more widespread, is because it's so misunderstood. And if I see my friends and family, for example, misunderstanding Bitcoin, then, and there's something I can do about it, I want to help those people to, you know, not miss this opportunity, because it's just, it's so weird. It's such a weird phenomenon / technology, because it is money itself, you know, it's bound up with money. So missing an opportunity, like missing the internet, if your mom and pop shop doesn't have a homepage for the first 15 years of the internet, it doesn't really matter that much. But if your mom and pop shop doesn't switch to Bitcoin standard soon enough, it might matter a lot. So I think that's the difference.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the post office and emails. I have the same experience every time I have to walk into a bank. I think I tweet about it every single time I go to a bank because I hate it that much now. If I need to go like get cash or send cash or whatever it needs to be that I have to physically drive and walk into a bank that if it was on the Bitcoin network, I could do instantly sitting at home. It's so frustrating. And you spend time, you wait in line. Usually, you know, you have to like give your ID and a couple forms of cards and, you know, tell them like information. It's like,
yeah,
it's just so, it seems so ridiculous to access your money that you have to do this or to get your money out or send money. It's like, why? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then as you dive more and more into Bitcoin, you're like, I never want to access a bank. Yeah. We're not quite there yet where like everything can be. Yeah. I mean, I know some people are, but like I still have my bank account. And so it's like, it's just funny. The world, like the people are like all in on Bitcoin. You're kind of living in like these two worlds at the same time.
I know this pain very, very well. I started a small company 2 years ago, and of course I was forced to set up a business bank account, and it took me, I think, 6 weeks and three different banks for me to be able to go through this hell and actually have a bank account that has it doesn't even have all the features that I wanted to have, but it was kind of acceptable and not outrageous. And it took such a long time, like it was ridiculous. And just, oh man. And you know, of course it costs an arm and a leg as well. So yeah, the banking sector can't die soon enough. Like
yeah, and then you hear the stories of like Peter McCormick who has his bank account shut down, and so then I'm sitting there like getting ready to send a wire transfer to, you know, one of the exchanges at one point, and I'm just like, oh gosh, if my bank account got shut down for this for whatever reason, that would just make my life so much harder and like for unnecessary reasons, and you like have to take time out of the working hours to go do it. Just like so many different things are so ridiculous about the banking industry.
Yeah it really is. I don't necessarily hope for the old system to crash and burn completely, because that would be just very chaotic and like not good for most people. But I really hope that either new banks emerge that do things a little bit differently and more efficiently and more cheaply and so on and so forth, or even like, you know, there are some, also with the rise of the internet, there were some companies that managed to adapt their business models to just survive this, and they switched to internet-based business models. And it might be true for the banking sector as well. So there might be some banks that are smart enough or under enough pain so that they accept Bitcoin in their heart and just build new business models around banking on Bitcoin. Because of course, that's something that it is something that will be needed. And we see this just, you know, with the existing kind of Bitcoin banks already. Because I mean, in Bitcoin, there's this saying, you be your own bank, and you definitely can be your own bank, but it's also not necessarily a simple task. And I would argue most people don't want to be their own bank. So with Bitcoin, of course, we can do things a lot differently than in the old world and in the old banking sector. But I think, you know, like there is a large addressable market for Bitcoin banking, and something like the Unchains and the Casas of the world that do collaborative custody, where you yourself cannot lose all your funds and shoot yourself in the foot. And if someone, you know, knocks at your door and wants to have your Bitcoin, there's nothing you can do for them. But it's still not all the power, not all the funds are concentrated in the banks. So you can, you know, very similar, like very similar to how highly secure weapon systems work, where you need both keys at the same time and turn it at the same time. You know, that's something you can do for Bitcoin as well. Like if you want to spend your funds, you have a system like this, and you can do it very securely and cryptographically. And that's what multi-signature and collaborative custody basically does. And I think that's something that's very new and also very misunderstood. Most people can't really make sense of it yet, but I think it's something that's desperately needed. And I see this as one of the core businesses for banks of the Bitcoin future.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of Unchained Capital and believe in what they're doing. And I've got a great team over there. And, you know, I recommend them to anyone who's looking and starting to, you know, really dive into what that looks like for the future in security. But then you've got other banks, you know, like Square is positioning themselves to be a major player in the banking industry within Bitcoin. Yeah. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if any of the old school banks, or not any, some will, which ones of the old school banks switch and when they switch and start to see the writing on the walls, because, you know, they don't have a reason to right now. They are the benefits of the old system to the highest extent. And so, you know, they want to ride that wave as long as possible, but at some point that wave's going to crash, and, you know, they've got to get out and see if they can, you know, pivot. And, you know, some of them, like you mentioned, are going to have problems, and it's going to be unfortunate. I mean, we don't like, a lot of people, I think, misunderstand like the Bitcoin community as like wanting to see the system crash. And
there are definitely some people that want to see this, but
I know. And it's sad. But, like, I try and think about, like, I don't want to see the system crash. I don't want my friends and family who have worked hard for their life savings to, you know, be put out of the house and home, which, you know, I don't think is going to happen. But, you know, it's going to take companies that are looking forward to the future to really, you know, have to dive in and do that. Because, you know, like with fractional reserve banking and what that is now, and the way it's structured, it's not a sustainable future for anything. Might as well, it won't work with Bitcoin. And it's just a crazy world that we live in now with the banking system.
Yeah, it's all kinds of crazy. That's definitely true. And again, I'm hopeful. I think, I mean, it's kind of a beautiful irony that those people that are most benefiting from the fiat system, like the central bankers of the world and the very large commercial banks, they seem to have the worst understanding of Bitcoin, and I think they will be the last to adopt the Bitcoin standard, which is really a beautiful irony. Like the closer you are to the money printers, the less inclined you are to use something like Bitcoin and adopt it, even though you should be well positioned, you know, like the pro move would be to print a bunch of money and buy Bitcoin. But most people haven't figured that out yet. You know, there's only Michael Saylor who's basically printing money by getting very cheap loans and going all in into Bitcoin with it. But it seems to me that Bitcoin has like a very ingenious way of selecting the right people to bring in. And so at the very early days, it was a lot of you know, like it was a lot of hackers and people that were very close to the Bitcoin ethos already. And as Bitcoin grew, the people, I would argue, got less extreme, like the audience got more wide, but it's still, you know, very on the libertarian side, very close to Austrian economics. You need to have a deep understanding of what money is, the history of money, how money works, properties of money, very security minded, very adversarial thinkers, and so on and so forth. And I think the people that are currently most benefiting from the fiat system, they are at the very, very outer rings, you know, like if you want to view Bitcoin as like an expanding ring, they will be the last that Bitcoin brings in. And I think that's one beautiful property of the Bitcoin system.
Definitely. And before we jump off of, you know, this subject with the banks, and would you mind diving into like a brief explanation of, you know, like what fractional reserve banking is and how it's hurt, you know, kind of what it's done to our monetary environment over the past, you know, 50 to 100 years.
It's very easy to explain, kind of, even though it sounds outrageous, but banks kind of found a way to lend out more money that they actually have in their vaults. So if you give me $100 and I have a fractional reserve requirement of 10%, then I can act as if I would have $1,000 and I can lend out your $100 like 10 times over. And that's basically how it works. You know, like they figured out that, okay, we're a bank, everyone is giving us the money. And it's similar to how airplanes are overbooked. Like if you have an airplane, and let's say the airplane seats 500 people, but you realize over time that you can sell 600 tickets and like a couple of people will never show up, and you never run into problems. You know, there is never a situation where all the people show up and so the plane is always full and you sell 110% of the tickets or whatever, you know, like that's actually how our airlines operate. Like that's actually what's happening. And the same is true for fractional reserve banking. It's like, okay, we have all this money in the bank, and we, of course, we want to lend money lend as much as possible, because that's basically the business model of a bank. You make money by lending money. And there is never a situation where we actually run out of money. You know, nobody can get, not all the people go to the bank and want to have their money. Like, there is way too much money at the bank all the time. And so that's how fractional reserve was born. You know, like if you think back to a gold standard, we had a fractional reserve on the gold standard as well. You know, it was just, you had a warehouse full of gold and you gave out paper certificates for this gold, and you realized, okay, not all the people are claiming all the gold all the time, so why not give out more paper certificates, and we'll just figure it out as we go along, kind of, you know. And so yeah, basically now we have a fractional reserve requirement of single digit percents, and in some cases even zero. And so you can just lend out, like create loans out of thin air. And that's basically how most money is created. Most money is actually not printed, but created via the fractional reserve system.
It's wild to think, like, one, we're never taught this in schools, but two, when you really look at it, it's like, who thought this was a good idea? You know, it's just crazy.
It's a great that this idea. Like, it's a great idea until it doesn't work anymore. You know, that's the problem with the fractional reserve system is also that it gets more and more extreme over time. You know, and also the people that are behind this, they are not stupid, and I also don't think, you know, there is a big large conspiracy and all those people are evil. I don't actually think that. I mean, definitely there are some evil people, but it's just like a system that kind of, you know, the system itself has its own needs and wants and ideas, just like a very large corporation. You know, it becomes its own thing. Nobody is really in control anymore. And like the whole banking sector, it makes money by giving out loans. Like it makes money by creating money, and you create money easiest by just giving out loans. And the best way to create these loans is via fractional reserve. And so reducing the fractional reserve requirement, it gives you exponential more leverage to create more loans. So reducing it, you know, from 10% to 2% or something, like you can create way more loans with that. And that's why it was happening. You know, people were just making more and more money at the banks. And it doesn't matter what kind of part of the system you look at, it's always the same story. It's just the same story is true for interest rates. You know, like, it's okay, might be a good idea to lower the interest rates and lower the interest rates, and then suddenly we're at 0% interest rate, and why not do negative interest rates? You know, like, it's like, I mean, it sounds good, it's completely nonsensical, but it doesn't matter. It's like what the system demands of the parameters. And yeah, all the signs, like having a 0% fractional reserve requirement and having negative interest rates, they're not signs of health of a monetary system.
Yeah, it's just an absolutely wild system that we're a part of. And one thing that you've touched on in the past is, I believe you said something along the lines of, you say it much more eloquently than I'm about to say it, but money trends toward the price of the cost of production. Mm-hmm. And with fractional reserve banking, like the cost of production of money is zero, because, you know, they just have money in the bank, they just press a button and more money appears. Mm-hmm. Can you dive into that a little bit more of how money trends towards the price of the cost of production, and then actually how, like, Bitcoin is fixing that in the way that the cost of production isn't zero?
Yeah. So in general, if there is competition, this should be true for most goods. You know, like if the only thing that is limited in this world is time. And there is actually a great book about this called The Ultimate Resource, which goes into that. So if you want to produce something, you have to invest time and resources, basically. And if you have someone else that produces the same thing, and he finds a way to make it cheaper, he will sell it to the market at a cheaper rate. And that's how prices will be found, like fair prices for these goods will be found. Of course, you know, there are exceptions with art and other things, but that's generally how things work. And this is also historically how it has worked for money. Like if you can create money very easily and cheaply, like that, you know, there is the saying, money doesn't grow on trees. And there is a reason why money doesn't grow on trees, because you can just go to the trees and pick the money. And that's not very good money, because everyone would have access to money. Money needs to have very peculiar properties for it to work well. And one of these properties is costliness. Like it needs to be very costly to produce. And that's why historically we used very scarce things as money, like gold, or if you're in the mountains, we use seashells. If you're at the sea, we used, I don't know what, you know, other things that were scarce. That's why we use diamonds as like proto money. That's why we used bones of animals that were very hard to hunt and other things. So it always like the cost of production is very important, that if money is too easy and too cheap to produce, you can make a lot of it very easily. And that's what destroys the value of the money, because if something is abundant, it doesn't, like if something is truly abundant, it doesn't cost anything. That's why we don't need to pay for the air we breathe. We don't need to pay for leaves on the trees. We don't need to pay for sand if we are at the beach. We don't need to pay for salt water if we are at the shorelines. So if something is abundant, it's just not good money. And if you money itself, it's not a special thing. It kind of is a special thing, but if you look at different situations, money is just a good like all other goods. It's just the most liquid good. And most liquid means like everyone will take it. Everyone, like nobody says no to money, you know? And depending on the situation, different kind of things become money, and everything has kind of a moneyness, you know? Like it's not a binary thing. In prisons, for example, like historically, cigarettes were money, because everyone, even non-smokers, wanted to have cigarettes because they could trade it for other things. So cigarettes were the most liquid good in prisons. Today, it's funnily enough, it's not cigarettes anymore. It's ramen noodles. And ramen noodles, like the packets, because they're very durable, you know, and you have different kinds of ramen noodles. So you have the beef one and the chicken one and the vegetable one and the, I don't know, the duck one. And they have different going rates. So the vegetable one is basically the $1 bill, and the chicken one is the $5 bill, and the beef one is like the $10 bill. And it's really funny how these systems emerge. And you can see this also in gaming economies, for example, like in some MMOs, money's emerged spontaneously, and you have different items that are very scarce that become money and stuff like that. So we see this all over history, and also currently in different situations, different things become money. And it's always related to, like the value of the money is always related to the cost of production, and by association, kind of like by the implication of it, is that it will be scarce. If something is very costly to produce, it will be scarce. Like that's basically what it means. And again, you know, like it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see what will go wrong if you have a money printer and you can just produce money at no cost, because you will find reasons to do this. Maybe you're just egotistical and want to enrich yourself. And if you flood the money with market, just like with every other good, the price of it will go down. Like the cost of the purchasing power of the money will go down. And it's the thought experiment I like to bring up always is, imagine, like, it doesn't matter how much money everyone has. Imagine you can snip with a finger, and just like that, everyone has twice the amount. What's going to happen? Did everyone get twice as rich? No, of course not. Like it's like I snipped with my finger and like your net worth was $10,000. Now it's $20,000. Did you get richer? No, not at all, because the market will figure out like that nothing actually happened. And the only thing that will happen is that pricing has got distorted, and everything, like after a couple of weeks or months or however long it takes, everything will be twice as pricey, you know? And if you have a money printer, the same thing is happening, but not simultaneously all over the world, but just for you. And then it takes more time to spread out. So if you have a money printer and you print yourself like more money, you're basically stealing from everyone else. That's what's going on. And that's what's happening at a very large scale right now.
Yeah, that was a very, very good explanation. And so one piece that you've written in the past that really changed my perspective and helped me to understand this more thoroughly was, I believe the title is it Bitcoin is time or Bitcoin is a clock?
Yeah, Bitcoin is time is the title.
Bitcoin is time. That's what I thought. It's very, first of all, I'll have it in the show notes and I'll have all of Gigi's links in the show notes, but incredible piece that really dives into how Bitcoin takes time and energy to produce, and it shapes it shapes your thinking in a way, because it's such a different way of thinking in the first place, because, you know, this monetary asset, it has to take time to produce, and time is money. Can you just dive into that piece a little bit for the listener who would probably assume that it hasn't listened or read it yet?
It's probably the most complicated thing I wrote so far. So it's really hard to sum up in a couple of minutes, but I'll try my best. So there are basically two aspects to the one phrase, Bitcoin is time. So as we discussed before, and as you correctly said, it has to, like, Bitcoin is literally stored time. Money is stored time. Like, money is used to store your economic energy, your economic output. And the only way, like, if you're thinking to very primitive monies and to very primitive societies, you put your time, you put in the hours, you produce something, you want to store what you created, and you use money for that. So money literally is stored time and energy. And so that's one aspect of the saying, like, Bitcoin is time. But the other aspect that the piece actually focuses more on is that for something like Bitcoin to work, you need to have a peculiar understanding of time in the system, because there are basically two different ways to do money. One is with physical artifacts like gold coins or seashells or diamonds or what have you. And the other one is with ledgers. And the big difference between the two is that you don't need time to keep track of gold coins, because I have a gold coin and I give it to you, and now you have the gold coin. It all happens by itself. Like, you can just by the distribution of the artifacts, by the distribution of the gold coins, it is clear who has what and who owes what to whom, who has how much money. If you put everything into a ledger and you remove all the physical artifacts, and that's basically the two types of money we had, like, since forever, you know, like, if you look at bar tabs, or if you look at, you know, also in ancient Egypt, you know, they had ledgers like who produced how much wheat and how much money is owed to whom, and so on and so forth. So everything that has to do with that kind of, it has to use ledgers. So you have to write down who owes what to whom. And it's always in a list. Like, a ledger is nothing else but a list with entries that will tell you, okay, Alice owes 10 shekels to Bob, and Bob owes 20 shekels to someone else, and so on and so forth. And for digital money to work, the only way we can make digital money work is with ledgers, because there is no way to produce something that acts like a physical token in the digital realm. And this is because of the double spend problem. Like, if you can read information, you can produce it perfectly. So there is no such thing as a digital token, because what we understand in the physical world as a token is something that you can't copy, you can't reproduce. And in a digital world, you can reproduce everything. I know I'm going on a tangent, but those things are very important. And so basically, we're stuck with ledgers in the digital world. And the problem with ledgers is that you need to know the order of things, because if I don't have the money already, I cannot spend it. So if Alice gives 10 shekels to Bob, and then Bob gives 10 shekels to Carol, it cannot go the other way around, because Bob needs to receive the money first before he can pass it on. And so the timing of things is very important. The order in which things happen is very, very important. And the main problem that Bitcoin solved is to tell time in a decentralized system. The problem with a decentralized system is that you don't have one clock that tells you exactly what the time is. And so you can't figure out what happened before and what happened after. And it's even way more tricky than that, because of relativistic effects. You can, like, this is an impossible problem to solve. It literally is an impossible problem to solve, and Bitcoin solves it, because we don't, in our physical universe, we don't have an absolute time in the first place. We don't have the concept of simultaneous events even. Like, if you look at Earth, from one end to the Earth to the other, it takes 50 milliseconds for light to travel. And like, if you had some physics in school, you will know that there is nothing faster than the speed of light. So to transmit information from one place to another, it will always take these 50 milliseconds. And you cannot figure out in this 50 millisecond time horizon what happened before and what happened after if two events happen inside these 50 milliseconds. So it's a really, really, really tricky problem. And it was one of the main problems that was unsolved in computer science. How can you synchronize a decentralized system? How can you do coordination in a decentralized system? How can you agree on the state of things in a decentralized system? And this is what, of course, is known as the Byzantine generals problem, because you can formulate it as a problem where some generals want to attack the country, and they are in an adversarial environment, and they are decentralized around the town, and they need to agree on the time when to attack the town, blah 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 blah. But that's basically the problem that Bitcoin solves, and it solves it in a very ingenious way by kind of paying miners to tell the network what time it is, and only using that time to order the events. So all transactions in Bitcoin have an absolute order. Every single transaction like goes in a step block fashion, block by block, and there is no mix up. Like there is no confusion about what happened first and what happened after. And you can understand Bitcoin as a decentralized clock, and the blocks that are coming in are like 1 second. You know, it's like tick, 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 tick. Every 10 minutes, a new tick comes in. And in this block, it behaves like one time step. You know, that's that's a one way to think about it. Like you have like one entry in the ledger that combines a bunch of transactions, and that's actually timestamping, decentralized timestamping, telling the time in a decentralized network is actually the problem, like one of the main problems that Satoshi solved. And that's also why I think 5 out of the 10 or so references in the Bitcoin white paper are about timestamping. It's all about timestamps, because to do money in the digital world, you need to do a ledger, and to do a ledger, you need to do timestamps. And that was a very long answer of what is in that article.
Oh, that was a great answer. Thanks for the summary there. For the listeners, please go read that article, and please go read his newest piece, Bitcoin is an Idea. Both have some very good information. And Gigi does a great job of explaining his thoughts, taking a little bit more time to do so, and really help you understand what he's come to understand with the way that Bitcoin works. And it's a pretty eye-opening thing to read. So thanks for the explanation there. So I've got one final question for you today before we wrap up. If, you know, we're going to assume that they know a little bit about internet and computers. If you could speak to one person, dead or alive, over a dinner, and just kind of explain to them, you know, what Bitcoin is and what it means to you and what it can mean for humanity, who would that be? And
Richard
why?
Feynman. Very easy answer for me.
Richard, that was quick. The quickest one yet.
No, very easy answer for me. Richard Feynman. He used to be a physicist. Unfortunately, he passed away. I think he passed away in 85 or something like that. Maybe later. I'm not sure. Something around that time. But he was a Nobel Prize winning physicist, and he was very interested in computers and also decentralized systems. So he would be a perfect person to talk to. And I just think he was one of the most amazing human beings to ever walk this planet. Like I've listened to all his lectures, read all his books, and I'm a huge fan of just how he thinks and understands the world, or like how he understood the world. And I would be very interested to hear what Richard Feynman would have to say about Bitcoin, because he was, in my book, he was an extraordinary genius, and he had a very peculiar view of the world. He had his own way of looking at things, and he always kind of stepped outside the box and saw things from a different perspective. And even without Bitcoin, I would just love to speak to the guy, even if it was only for 5 minutes.
That's awesome. It'd be very cool to see, especially somebody like that who their life's work was in and around something so similar, and you would assume that they could kind of pick up on it pretty quickly and see the power that it could hold.
Yeah, he was a very smart cookie, so I would hope that he would catch up to Bitcoin quite quickly. And he was working on Yeah, he like he was a pioneer in many fields. Like his biggest contributions were to quantum mechanics and quantum chromodynamics, and he made so many breakthroughs in just our understanding of the universe. But he also worked on computation a lot. Like he was also involved in the Manhattan Project, and did he was leading one of the computational units, so he knew a lot about computers and computation in general. And he was working on something that he called the analytical engine, I think, which was basically one of the first architectures of a computing system that was connected like a hypercube. So you can it's like a cube in four dimensions, so it has a lot of connections to other nodes, kind of, you know. So that was what he was working on. And also he worked a lot on at least in theory on nano technology and nanorobots. So he was a big fan of, you know, like just doing everything on as small a scale as possible, because it's just super effective in terms of, you know, not using any energy. And that's, of course, you know, what our computers are doing, you know, like, and also what ASICs are doing, like the bringing everything down to the molecular and atomic level. You don't have to move a lot to do something, you know, and you don't have, like, if you can store a zero in one atom and a one in another atom, then it's just very efficient to store a lot of data. And those were the things that he was interested in. And I think he would have some interesting ideas and some interesting things to say once Bitcoin is explained to him.
Wow, it sounds like if he were still around today, he could actually, you know, have some contributions for the field. So.
Yeah, I think so.
I think you two, I'd love to be a fly on the wall for that conversation. I would very, very certainly be the dumbest guy in that room. And I could sit silent for a few hours and listen. Gigi, though, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate you coming on the show and, you know, just being willing to give your time and spread your knowledge. Tell the people where they can find you at, and I'll make sure to have links for everything in the show notes.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks again for having me. I had a great time. That was a great conversation. Yeah, keep up with what you're doing. Like, as I said, you know, I really enjoyed the conversations that you had so far. And I think it's very important for Bitcoin in general that just, you know, a lot of people present their own take and do their own spin and just explore Bitcoin for themselves. So yeah, just keep it up. And people can find me easily on Twitter. I think that's the best place. If you're into shit posts, that's definitely the best place. if you're more into some of my long form writing, I have everything on my homepage, which is just my Twitter handle, theregg.com. And yeah, that's basically it. I try to move away from all the other platforms. I have some things up on Medium as well, but I don't want to use it anymore because it's just it's getting worse by the minute. I feel like it. They try to introduce paywalls and all doing all kinds of shenanigans. So I try to self-host everything I can. And yeah, other than that, don't be afraid to reach out. My DMs are open. I'm usually kind of responsive as time allows, but I usually reply within a day or two.
Wonderful. Well, yeah, like I said, I will have links to all that in the show notes. His Twitter handle is DerGigi, DerGigi. And you can check the show notes for that. Gigi, again, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it and look forward to future conversations with you.
Thanks for having me.
Man, how about that episode with Gigi? I've always enjoyed and appreciated learning from him through his writings, and being able to learn firsthand was a great experience. Thanks again, Gigi, for your time. As always, everything is in the show notes. Please check them out and give Gigi's articles a read. He has some great insights and thoughts. I have a few more great guests on the book for the next couple of weeks that I can't wait to record and release, so make sure you subscribe so that you see those when they come out. And if you would, I would greatly appreciate a rating and review on iTunes as well. I appreciate your support and time, and I'll catch you soon. Take us away, Brode.